This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Plot to Destroy Democracy, How Putin and His Spies Are Undermining America and Dismantling the West. Written by Malcolm Nance with a foreword by Rob Reiner. Read by Peter Ganim. Foreword. In 2016, the United States was attacked by a foreign enemy power. Unlike the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor or Al-Qaeda's attack on the World Trade Center, the attack by the Russian Federation struck at the core of our democracy, our free and fair election system. The purpose was to destroy our system of self-governance that we have cherished and held up as an example to the world for over 240 years, carried out in stealth, using state-run news media and intelligence agencies. Russia managed to influence the election with the express purpose of aiding their preferred candidate, Donald J. Trump. The Kremlin took advantage of our open society, and through social media and agents of influence, they deployed ex-KGB spies to spread blackmail, forgery, and propaganda. Putin loyalists, neo-Nazis, fascists, and racist xenophobes had and continue to have but one mission— use the freedoms afforded to us to halt, attack, and destroy democracy from without and within. With the election of a childish, self-dealing, autocratic narcissist, we see evidence of the Kremlin's success. Donald Trump's contemptuousness of our inclusive values, our norms, and the rule of law, along with his weak support of NATO and the European Union, has elevated Russia on the global stage. One of our founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin, once wondered why Benedict Arnold would sell out 3 million Americans to King George for £20,000. Today, we face another question. Why would a failing real estate developer turned reality show host cozy up to an autocrat who rules over a kleptocracy? Will we come to find that 320 million Americans have been sold out to the Kremlin for 20 billion rubles? As of this writing, the United States and Europe have been standing up to the attacks on the pillars of democracy, but we the people must be the strongest pillar of all, and we must heed the warnings of the risks to our beloved system of government that continue to come. To that end, we can have no better Paul Revere than Malcolm Nance. Rob Reiner. Introduction. One of the greatest dreams of the old Soviet Union was to put a highly suggestible American ideologue into power who would do the bidding of the Kremlin. For nearly a century, Russia wanted to change American policy in such a way that its economy and alliances with NATO would be so damaged that the Soviet Union would become the preeminent superpower in the world. The idea of a Kremlin-controlled president would live on after the death of the Soviet Union. In 2012, the plan to subject the 2016 United States election to a massive cyber influence operation, possibly in coordination with the Trump campaign, was launched. It ostensibly started with the hacking of the Democratic National Committee's servers in order to steal critical information to knock Hillary Clinton out of the running for President of the United States. The plan would eventually work to the benefit of Russia's chosen candidate, Donald Trump. On November 8, 2016, the American presidential election culminated into what could arguably be called the greatest intelligence operation in the history of the world. In the Russian attack on the American election, a strategic adversary influenced enough voters through manipulation of the internet to get their preferred candidate chosen, and convinced more than 40% of the American population that they had nothing whatsoever to do with it. I was determined to track down other information to illustrate where Russian intelligence used cyber warfare to influence elections, referenda, and political opinion to their advantage. My investigation showed that Russian intelligence had been using these advanced malware suites to attack other nations for almost a decade. The 2016 election hacking was just window dressing on a larger goal. I found there were many activities where the Russian cyber bears, a collective name for their national, criminal, and intelligence hackers, were involved in shifting the goalposts. The 2016 hacking was the start of a global campaign to imagine a new world order and make it a Russian world order. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, and the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, codenamed the Russian operation against the United States, Grizzly Step. In my last book, The Plot to Hack America, I referred to it as Operation Lucky Seven, considering the amount of luck the Russian spies would need. The next phase of their campaign, the plot to destroy democracy, would be better described as Global Grizzly. The best plan would be to resort back to a goal from the Soviet era, discredit and destroy Western-style democracy altogether. This time, Americans would be curried through their hatred of Muslims and their first African-American president, Barack Obama, to align themselves through cultural similarities as opposed to Cold War politics. In the Global Grizzly Plan, tribal commonalities among white ethno-nationalists would be cemented through a political order based on authoritarianism, anti-liberalism, and anti-globalism, and lever the success of the super-rich. By 2016, Operation Global Grizzly was occurring right before our eyes. It was the full-scale implementation of a new form of asymmetric warfare. Although Russia was a military superpower, it remained an economic dinosaur, with the exception of fossil fuel production. In order to defeat a superior economic entity like the United States, Russia embraced a new battlefront that could cripple a democratic adversary. It would exacerbate the domination of the information battle space. In The Plot to Destroy Democracy, I will reveal the strategy the Russian Federation put into effect to defeat the world's biggest democracies and challenge principal governance structures of the Western world. The singular beauty of this plan, which has roots far back into Stalin's Soviet Union, is that the Russian political chess players have harnessed the West's own technology and liberty as the dagger to be plunged into the heart of democratic governance. Russia saw opportunity to co-opt American and European political parties to destroy democracy itself. At its heart, The Plot to Destroy Democracy is a fast-paced cross between a spy thriller and a national intelligence estimate that provides a deep-dive assessment of the dangers that surround the nation where the enemies are both foreign and domestic. However, the game remains in motion. All the pieces are still visible, and a bulldog of an investigator, former FBI Director Robert Mueller, is on the hunt. Make no mistake, democracy in the era of Trump and Putin is in retreat and has been targeted for extinction. With the right amount of public awareness, determination, and dedication to the principles we hold dear and love, it can be stopped. Section 1. Cyber Bears. Chapter 1. Shots Fired. On November 8, 2016, Vladimir Putin became the first Russian president of the United States. What could arguably be called the greatest intelligence operation in the history of the world had been executed, and the result was that the candidate Moscow had supported had won. Putin didn't care what happened next. He was certain that with Trump in power, the American public would be so enmeshed with chaos that they would be completely indifferent on how to respond, if they responded at all. That was the weakness with democracy. It required consensus, process, and time. Putin relied on none of that. He had ordered and executed a daring political mission. His cyber spies, state-run news media, and his elite global rich, the oligarchs, had successfully influenced the American public's mindset so deeply they were in total denial that it had been done at all. As both Baudelaire and Kaiser Soze said, que la plus belle des ruses du diable est de vous persuader qu'il n'existe pas. The best trick of the devil was to convince you he didn't exist. The political party controlling the U.S. Congress, the Republican Party, had dedicated itself for 8 years to destroying any positive action by President Barack Obama. Hillary Clinton, his Secretary of State, was likely to be the Democratic Party's front-runner and even more likely to be the next President of the United States. Putin's personal hatred of both seemed to be the key motivating factor that caused him to intervene. But luck was on his side in 2016 because all of the actors and stages that the Russian Federation had cultivated over a decade were in place to effect a change bigger than a U.S. president. Russia had taken a modest distrust of Hillary Clinton and had used the Republican Party's own argument, but Hillary's emails, and had turned it into a weapon. Russia capitalized on the repeated investigations into Clinton's emails that were found on a secure server in her Secret Service protected home. It was an easy target. When the election was done, America had fractured. Russia had exerted its asymmetric power to elect Donald J. Trump to the highest office in the West, and it had succeeded beyond its dreams. With this, they'd get the Magnitsky Act and Crimea sanctions lifted. Russian investments would become highly desired vehicles again, but to sustain Putin's dream, the real goal must be attained. Put an end to liberal democracy in America and Europe and bring about a worldwide conservative renaissance. It wasn't a very difficult job, despite the perils of running an integrated intelligence mission against the world's premier superpower. Like the 9/11 attacks, American politicians and the public just did not have the imagination to believe that Putin would dare do something so intrusive. U.S. intelligence did have the imagination, as well as the information that both Moscow and Beijing could pull off such a stunt, but the military and intelligence leadership was responsive to politicians. One could warn till one is blue in the face, but intelligence produces warnings. Politicians must act on them. In the end, Putin won with the aid of Americans who had turned on their own values. The news media assisted greatly by elevating stolen, innocuous emails from an insecure party server to a national crisis in which the victims were treated suspiciously. To Trump supporters, it validated everything they ever suspected about Hillary Clinton. She hid emails, which meant she was a liar. No matter that Trump voters elected a man who openly embraced white supremacy, rejected diversity, abhorred global engagement, ignored his own corruption, and enlisted his own family and staff as royalty to be worshipped. Trump voters saw these traits as perks. They viewed nepotism, largesse, and excess as virtues of a business and political shark. If he vocally stood against virtually all gains America had made in equality and global economic expansion since 1964, and it got him elected, then all the better that he hold those positions. By all means necessary was Trump's apparent motto for the 2016 election. Russian intelligence lived by that motto, too. The spies of the Red Square were shameless enough, but the real scandal was that Team Trump saw nothing wrong with it. Trump voters had blindly elected him despite knowing that Russia had intervened in the electoral process. They cared not that Trump's own surprising level of slavish devotion to Putin was suspicious. It did not matter. Trump had created a cult of personality in the white lower class so that they worshipped his every word and challenged the veracity of anything negative said against him. This worked out well for Putin. For the new Russian president of the United States, the original goal had been to just make America consume itself in partisanship and beat them on the global market to return to economic supremacy. Now, with the election of Trump, America would become fundamentally dysfunctional. More importantly, Russia would gain an ally that would release its illicit billions stolen from them by the Obama administration through sanctions. It had taken a decade to earn those hundreds of billions of dollars through the theft of former Soviet assets. Liquidating Russian shipyards and airports and selling off everything from tanks to chemical factories had been a tough business where only the toughest could survive. Led by an ex-KGB officer, Russia was about to embark on a path to a new era of global leadership. Yet Americans were fickle, and the "yes, we can" of Barack Obama had splintered the nation to the point that just a few subtle strokes of assistance, financial and ideological, would shift the U.S. into Moscow's orbit. It was a tough shot, and if it failed, the damage could become permanent. But Vladimir Putin dared to take it, and in the 2016 American election, it paid off. Fresh bear tracks. The plot to hack America, given the FBI codename Operation Grizzly Step, was executed early in the summer of 2015. Russian military intelligence hackers executed a long-term plan to penetrate the servers of the Democratic National Committee, DNC. It was technically simple. The GRU, an acronym for Glavnoye Razvedivatelnoye Upravlenie, or Main Intelligence Directorate, used the lax computer security of the Americans, which allowed their spies to gain access to the servers. The Russian army spies ran rampant for as long as 7 to 10 months before the threat was detected. They copied what they wanted and left no part of the DNC untouched. Someone in the U.S. intelligence community must have noticed the attempts. In September 2015, the FBI sent the DNC a notice that their computer systems were being probed by an undesignated foreign actor. The DNC did perfunctory checks and detected nothing out of the ordinary. They would already be too late. The Russian army spies were well into the system and operating almost invisibly. They were using a suite of cyberware known as Advanced Persistent Threat 29, ATP-29. It was a well-known hacking suite that had been nicknamed by many companies, but the one that stuck was coined by the cybersecurity company CrowdStrike, Cozy Bear. The people behind the software were a cell of Russian Army intelligence soldiers using a highly sophisticated suite of malware in their attacks. This wasn't the first time the GRU deployed Cozy Bear. It had been used many times around the world and had been used to penetrate the White House and Pentagon servers in 2014 and 2015. It was the GRU's go-to penetration system. To get into a civilian agency such as the DNC, it was child's play. In the past, they could get into White House staffers' logins, so an American political party was cake. Yet while the GRU was successful in owning the DNC, a very specific attack was carried out by another spy entity known as APT-28 and nicknamed Fancy Bear. This malware belonged to the cyber spies of the Russian intelligence agency, the FSB. The State Security Directorate, the FSB, was the heir to the entire legacy and corporate knowledge of the villainous Soviet spy agency, KGB. They changed their acronym when the USSR fell. In fact, once Russia lost its communist ideology, the former KGB became far more powerful in computing power. In the cybersecurity world, Fancy Bear was well known to be controlled by the Russia State Security Agency, the FSB. The only difference between the modern-day FSB and its overseas clandestine service branch, the SVR, and the ruthless KGB is that the FSB has a much bigger budget and more latitude for overseas operations. The FSB ignored the GRU team in the DNC hack and stole a single yet specific folder of opposition research in their Fancy Bear software. An opposition research folder is all the dirt a political party collects on another party's opponent. The Republicans had 17 candidates and the Democrats had folders on each, but the FSB stole the folder for one specific person, Donald J. Trump. In June 2016, the CEO of CrowdStrike, Dmitry Alperovitch, published the findings of the DNC hack. The paper is titled Bears in the Midst, Intrusion into the Democratic National Committee, and it publicly accused Russian spies of conducting the DNC hacking. It was well received in the cybersecurity community, but detractors in the Republican Party, particularly those of the now front-runner Donald Trump, did not agree with the Russian findings. A few days after the CrowdStrike report, a WordPress blog written by someone using the name Guccifer 2.0 appeared on the internet. The entity claimed that he penetrated the DNC by himself, a lone hacker. Cybersecurity experts were immediately suspicious because that name was apparently an homage to Guccifer, a prolific Romanian hacker who repeatedly read and published the emails of Colin Powell and other luminaries. Since the real Guccifer was sitting in a U.S. prison and cooperating with the FBI, who was this guy? Journalists and cybersecurity experts quickly surmised that the person on the blog was likely a Russian citizen due to a poor understanding of Romanian language and was using a Russian language keyboard. No matter, Guccifer 2.0 started to publicly release data stolen by the Cozy Bear Fancy Bear hacks. He started first by releasing DNC financial reports, a dossier on Hillary Clinton, and other materials that could only have come from DNC computer servers. However, the Guccifer persona was met with skepticism and derision. Apart from the cybersecurity world, its story was not making headway. That changed immediately when Julian Assange's WikiLeaks organization announced it had the DNC emails. The effect was galvanizing. The entire global media stood up and paid attention. On July 22, 2016, WikiLeaks flooded the global media with 19,252 stolen DNC emails from senior DNC staff, including the communications director and the senior finance team. The materials appeared to focus on discussions designed to split the Democratic Party by revealing then-chairperson Debbie Wasserman Schultz's views on Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Schultz was a close personal friend of Clinton, so it was no surprise she supported her, and the release of the emails was timed to occur just before the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. The intent of the leak was clear: split the Bernie Sanders faction from the Democrats and damage Hillary Clinton among independent and progressive voters. It worked like a charm. The first morning of the convention, Bernie Sanders supporters walked out, staged loud protests, and even publicly shouted Donald Trump's schoolyard nickname for the nominee, Crooked Hillary. The Friday before the Democratic Party's convention in Philadelphia, I was in New York City to provide analysis and commentary related to possible terrorist and security threats to the convention. As the counterterrorism analyst for MSNBC, I was kept hanging around their makeshift studio. The temporary studio had an elevated and breathtaking view of Independence Hall. I felt the pride of Jefferson, Franklin, and the others who had come to that spot to tirelessly create history. In the air was a feeling of jubilation and inevitability that America would overwhelmingly reject the hatred, bigotry, and mean-spiritedness of the previous week displayed at the Republican convention. The Republican convention in Cleveland and its process to nominate self-described billionaire Donald J. Trump as their candidate for president was a visceral parade of grievance, rejection, and near open appeals to racism. It became apparent to everyone watching, even a lifelong Republican myself, that the party would show a willingness to fight as dirty as possible and go as deep into the mud as one could go, and maybe a step lower. The convention was reported accurately as a massive grievance festival. While the Republican convention unfolded, numerous shenanigans to get rid of Trump were floated and shot down among the party establishment. In the end, the Republicans nominated arguably the most divisive person to run for president since Abraham Lincoln, and we all know how that ended. Consequently, the Democratic Party was poised to stand on an air of cooperation, strength through diversity, compassion, and love. First Lady Michelle Obama's slogan, "When they go low, we go high," would resonate with Hillary Clinton's supporters. It would allow Bernie Sanders' following to come together with Clinton's and close ranks the way she'd done with Barack Obama's nomination in 2008. Everyone looked forward to a rousing party. At my Independence Hall standby location, I kept watch just in case a terrorist group or individual would attempt to break up the Hillary love fest with guns, bombs, or worse. There were no indications of a terrorist threat, but for almost 4 months I had been aware of a different kind of threat. As part of my continuing counterterrorism study, I had been drafting a manuscript for a new book titled Hacking ISIS. I was writing it with my chief researcher and co-author, Chris Sampson. We had been working on the manuscript for more than a year to provide the deepest dive on the terrorist group's success at hijacking social media. While researching ISIS's tactics, we came across two efforts that seemed at odds with the terrorists' capabilities. The hacking of TV5 in Paris, a major television network that broadcasts internationally to the entire Francophone world, and the Warsaw Stock Exchange. On the surface, both of these efforts were carried out by hackers of the Islamic State terrorist group, but forensic analysis showed that the entity used in conducting the attack was confirmed to be Fancy Bear. I watched with interest when news of the WikiLeaks trove came out. One glance at the data revealed to me that they had the stolen DNC information that had been taken by Cozy and Fancy Bear. WikiLeaks was clearly acting as a Russian laundromat for stolen material. It immediately became clear to me, and my brothers and sisters in U.S. intelligence, that a massive cyber warfare operation was afoot. I had been the first to publicly declare on national television that the United States had been subjected to a wide-ranging cyber and political warfare attack. My breathless warning was, in reality, an intelligence estimate. My call to alarm was based on my background as a career cryptologic collections operative in naval intelligence. I was an heir to the legacy of the codebreakers and analysts who had seen the breadcrumbs that led to numerous victories, such as the Battle of Midway and Operation Desert Storm, and failures including Pearl Harbor and 9/11. Although my career background was in Middle Eastern state sponsors of terrorism and warfare from Libya to Syria to Afghanistan, I was a child of the Cold War spy world. When I was first read into the top-secret code word world, the first briefings were not about Libyan spies, Saddam's assassins, or Iranian Vevak agents. It was a massive counterintelligence indoctrination on the activities and operations of the former Russian intelligence agency, the Komitet Gosudarstvennoy Bezopasnosti, the KGB. The KGB was a worldwide threat during the Cold War that enveloped every intelligence operative and analyst in the West. Their ability to identify, seduce, and turn intelligence professionals into spies who betray their own nation was legendary. The counterintelligence motto was, "Beware of the bears are everywhere." Their military forces were our primary targets, but their spies were far less visible and insidious. The motto was true. Throughout most of my career, the KGB and its successors, the FSB and SVR, was literally everywhere our missions took us. A souk in Marrakesh, a cafe in the Casbah in Algiers, a men's room in Naples, or a bar in Port Said. There they were. The KGB knew where Americans were and had assets or agents looking to surveil engage, and recruit. KGB officers and propagandists routinely criticized our military activities, funded terrorists from the Irish Republican Army via one of my targets, Libya, and ran Palestinian insurgency training camps in the deserts of Syria and the refugee camps of southern Lebanon. They facilitated dictators and despots across the Eastern Hemisphere. Annually, we were briefed on Russian intelligence operations which were enmeshed with our targets everywhere from Iraq to Spain. When I added one and one together with the DNC hack, the Guccifer 2.0 blog, and the WikiLeaks data dump, it was an obvious, large-scale, old-school, KGB-style Russian information warfare operation. It could have but one goal: elect Donald Trump president. It was bold. It was daring, and it could only have been directed by Vladimir Putin. I said this loudly and repeatedly throughout the campaign. However, there was much skepticism. I was not alone in my analysis of the breadcrumbs, but the news media were interested in the emails and not the source. The more stolen data that were released, the more voraciously the media covered the story. Television and internet news consumed with reports of emails had little critical analysis. The actual emails revealed nothing, but the word was in the air. After a month's hiatus to turn the data over to WikiLeaks, Guccifer 2.0 popped back up to work in concert with WikiLeaks. They released freshly stolen documents that revealed another Democratic Party institution was hacked. This time, it was the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, DCCC. In addition, a disturbing pattern was emerging. When Donald Trump would give speeches complaining about a certain subject, within days, entire dumps of DNC and DCCC emails on that subject would hit the news media from both Guccifer 2.0 and WikiLeaks. For example, emails on Pennsylvania and Florida primaries were released soon after Trump mentioned them. When he disparaged Nancy Pelosi, a huge tranche of documents on her was released. The flood continued with the entire DNC databases for New Hampshire, Ohio, Illinois, and North Carolina hitting the streets, all Democratic battleground states that Trump eventually won. I spent days on television warning that there was a cyber war designed to destroy the Democratic Party and tilt the election in favor of Donald Trump. Aside from MSNBC, the news media largely ignored the spy story unfolding before their eyes and breathlessly awaited the new stolen tranches. On August 21st, Roger Stone, the Nixonian Republican dirty trickster, hinted that he had advanced information about the WikiLeaks releases on John Podesta, the campaign chairman of the Clinton team. He tweeted that Podesta's time in the barrel will come. A statement such as this was perplexing at the time, but it appeared to be Stone's classic foreshadowing of a political dirty trick. A few weeks later, it would become one of the first of many signs of possible collusion between Trump supporters and Russia via their laundromat, WikiLeaks. Like clockwork, in mid-September 2016, a new website, DC Leaks, suspected of being another Russian front, published email chains from John Podesta, some of which included messages to Hillary Clinton but did not expose anything more sinister than a risotto recipe. That was the least of it. September and October brought an endless flood of leaks. DC Leaks released the schedules of key Clinton staff and a copy of Michelle Obama's passport. Each of them appeared to be timed to whatever bad news the Trump team was facilitating at the time. The impact of the stolen email flood was to keep the U.S. news media fed with day-after-day coverage of Democratic Party emails. It didn't matter that they were extremely benign or that none of them was from Hillary Clinton's email server. The media ate it up. Spy hunters of the world, unite! Soon after the release of the Guccifer 2.0 data, a serious question was being asked aloud by the more enlightened global punditry. Was Trump's team working with Russia? The fact that the Trump team insisted on removing a core platform piece on the arming of Ukraine made many eyebrows rise. That was a key Russian desire that had never been entertained. But now, coordinated or not, both Russia and the Republicans played the email scandal brilliantly. Initially conceived as a ploy to hammer Clinton on the grounds of national security during the Benghazi hearings, Republicans would come to work in sync with the conservative media on the matter of emails. Websites such as InfoWars and Breitbart News claimed all the releases showed criminal intent. They saw each email release as proof that the Clinton machine was corrupt beyond all reason. On October 4, 2016, just as Donald Trump was accusing the Clinton Foundation of corruption, Guccifer 2.0 claimed to have hacked the Foundation's servers. The documents were actually from the DCCC batch, but the Republicans and the news media treated it like gospel. Trump hyped this news even as his own foundation was revealed to have been used to funnel money to his family coffers. If Trump was not in conspiracy with Russia, then his mouth did him no favors. As early as July 27, 2016, just 48 hours after the disastrous DNC opening day, Trump appealed to Moscow to hack and release even more emails. Trump said, "By the way, if they hacked, they probably have her 33,000 emails. I hope they do. They probably have her 33,000 emails that she lost and deleted. Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing." To U.S. intelligence and counterintelligence agencies and professionals, this statement would be a key point from which to piece the data together that would lead to the most serious national security investigation in American history. The question on the table became, were Americans working in concert with a foreign intelligence agency to elect a president? Unbeknownst to Donald Trump and the American public, the spy hunt for a conspiracy with Russia was already underway. Trump was suspected to be a Russian asset much earlier than his "Russia, if you're listening" speech. One person with doubts was John Brennan, the soft-spoken but tough director of the CIA who had worked for the clandestine service for over 25 years. He held the position of CIA station chief in Saudi Arabia and specialized in counterterrorism. However, he was an old-school spy. He was well-schooled in Russian intelligence operations. As the CIA director during the 2016 elections, any information related to Russian shenanigans during the election would have fallen under his rubric. Early in 2016, he would be informed of the DNC hack and Russian efforts to co-opt members of Trump's campaign. Brennan would task his agency's Russia team to work with the National Security Agency to scrub what information they had so President Obama could be briefed. He sent out feelers to intelligence agencies around the world for information. Soon, three allied foreign intelligence agencies would bring him and the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, unambiguous intelligence that Russia was going in strong to win the election for Donald Trump. U.S. intelligence and the counterintelligence spy hunters of the FBI now understood they were dealing with something completely different than the cyber espionage officers assisting in the DNC hack. We intelligence officers are suspicious of coincidences. In the spy world, coincidences just don't exist. I coined the phrase Nance's Law to remind new operatives that in the shadows of espionage, coincidence takes a lot of planning. By midsummer, the intelligence community was awash with more than coincidences. They had red flags. A red flag was a Cold War-era counterintelligence term that meant Russian intelligence active measures were suspected or detected. One set of red flags stood out. The FBI and other agencies had learned that members of the Trump campaign were meeting with Russians virtually everywhere. Worse, they were denying the meetings happened. By election time, there would be over 12 senior administration or campaign officials who held 19 face-to-face meetings and or had more than 51 communications with Russians associated with the Kremlin. Most of them would deny these contacts until confronted, and then would claim coincidence. Obviously, they were hiding something. But what? The Storm of Chaos. The FBI's National Security Branch, NSB, is a group of highly specialized counterintelligence officers who seek out enemy spies and terrorists in the United States. For almost 80 years, the NSB and its predecessors tracked down espionage threats when they arrived on American shores. From Soviet communist agents sent by Stalin, Nazi saboteurs landed by Hitler, or Al-Qaeda and ISIS sleeper cells, the NSB does one thing: watch, hunt, detect, and capture enemy agents. Early in spring 2016, intelligence was flowing in from the CIA and NSA that something was afoot with the hacking of the DNC. Reports that Americans were in contact with known Russian assets and agents soon followed. British news media reported that signals intelligence, known as SIGINT, was coming in from the British counterpart to the American NSA, the British General Communications Headquarters, GCHQ. NATO sister agencies in Europe were also warning that they had solid intelligence Americans were in communications with known Russian intelligence officers. The director of GCHQ had personally passed this information on to DNI Clapper, CIA Director Brennan, and NSA Director Admiral Michael Rogers. It was in March 2016 that a young Trump supporter named George Papadopoulos came to the attention of the FBI and the CIA. Papadopoulos was a senior foreign policy advisor to Donald Trump, who had been present at a meeting with Trump and Jeff Sessions in mid-March 2016. According to the New York Times, Papadopoulos inadvertently revealed his role in a plot when he bragged about his Russian connections while drinking in London with Australian diplomat Alexander Downer. Papadopoulos told Downer that Russia had thousands of Hillary Clinton's emails and intimated that they were going to benefit the campaign. Papadopoulos had found himself in contact with a Maltese citizen, Joseph Mifsud. Mifsud had met Papadopoulos in early March, but had ignored him. Once Mifsud discovered Papadopoulos was a Trump campaign advisor, his interest changed. They worked out a scheme to arrange a meeting between Trump and Putin. Mifsud coordinated a meeting with a young woman he called his niece, Olga Polonskaya. She was accompanied by Ivan Timofeyev, the head of a Russian academic forum tied to the Kremlin's foreign ministry. The Australian was alarmed that an American would be caught in such an obvious spy trap. Downer would report back to his superiors, who would then pass it on to Australian agents and U.S. intelligence. The FBI started to investigate Papadopoulos as a potential Russian asset. Eventually, Papadopoulos would be questioned about these contacts, and like virtually every other member of the Trump team, he would lie. Only when arrested by the FBI would he confess the plan. At nearly the exact same time, another Trump foreign policy advisor, Carter Page, was claiming to be a global expert in the Russian energy industry, even though no one had heard of him. Page claimed to have worked for 7 years for Merrill Lynch in London and Moscow. He also claimed to have been assigned to Lynch in New York as Chief Operating Officer of the Energy and Power Group. What is known is that Page did work for 3 years in Moscow, coordinating the merger of Gazprom and RAOUES. These relations were critical to convincing Trump of his bona fides. Trump brought him onto the campaign as an expert on Russia. Trump even mentioned him by name when asked who was on his foreign policy team. By September 2016, his name would figure highly when it was cited in a secret dossier developed by former British Secret Intelligence Service agent, MI6, Christopher Steele. Steele developed a 35-page package of rumors and observations about Donald Trump and his campaign, based on information gathered by his former spy contacts. He worked these tips up into a dossier for Fusion GPS, a political research group hired first by conservative donors working for Ted Cruz and then Democrat donors. In the Steele dossier, Page's name came up in relation to an oil deal between Exxon and Russian oil giant Rosneft. When this became public, Page quickly left the campaign. Upon further inquiry, the FBI spy hunters would find these two low-level staffers were the least of the contacts. An investigation by the New York Times of Trump's campaign manager Paul Manafort would expose his ties to the Kremlin through his illicit dealings in Ukraine. Former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency Michael Flynn earned tens of thousands of dollars speaking to Russia Today. He even sat next to Putin at their 10th anniversary dinner, along with American Green Party head Jill Stein. Other higher-ranked Americans had met secretly with Russians and were caught lying about it, including the Attorney General Jeff Sessions and the president's son-in-law Jared Kushner. They were all found to have been in contact with Moscow. U.S. intelligence and the FBI were now on the case. While the news media mused about the coincidences, the global intelligence community was hard at work running down the perpetrators of the hacks. One agency was the Dutch General Intelligence and Security Service, Algemene Inlichtingen en Veiligheidsdienst, or AVID. AVID was a European intelligence ally that maintained a highly regarded cyber warfare division. It was a small, classified program that developed a highly specialized computer warfare capability to counter Russian intelligence operations. AVID was part of an international intelligence sharing agreement by NATO nations, which allocated targets set by the two major signals intelligence powers, NSA and GCHQ. Each nation had its strengths and weaknesses. Where highly refined exploitation was required, every nation in NATO contributed. In cyber operations, AVID was exceptional and was given one of the toughest nuts in the world to crack. They hacked Russian intelligence's own offices. The story of how the Dutch managed to exploit the FSB was broken by local newspaper De Volkskrant. For several years, AVID had been focusing on Russian cyber warfare operations related to the FSB. As a counter to Russian hacks against NATO, the Pentagon, the White House, and France, the Dutch had developed highly specialized exploitation tools and techniques that allowed them to geographically track Russian army intelligence systems. The Dutch formed a joint SIGINT cyber unit made up of federal civilian and military intelligence staffers tasked to attack hostile networks. Their specialty was Cozy Bear. Using secret methodologies, they were able to pinpoint the location of the servers to a building in Moscow. In a stroke of brilliance, they counterhacked the security cameras on one particular floor of the building and observed the Russian spies using the system. CIA Director John Brennan reported the AVID and other agencies' intelligence on the Russian campaign to James Clapper. The intelligence picture was disturbing. It revealed Russia was conducting a massive active measures operation against the United States election. As information started to pour into the major intelligence agencies, John Brennan was made the point man for processing the traffic by President Obama. DNI Clapper was the overall coordinator and policy manager for the 17 U.S. intelligence agencies that were collecting the information. Brennan and Clapper agreed the Russian attack required a forceful American response. On August 4, 2016, at the direction of Obama, Brennan personally telephoned the director of the Russian intelligence agency, FSB Chief Alexander Bortnikov. According to his testimony before the House Intelligence Committee, Brennan warned Bortnikov that the United States was aware of their operations and that it would damage relations between the two countries. Apparently, Putin knew Americans better than that. By September, Russian WikiLeaks email releases accelerated. The ex-director would later tell the House Intelligence Committee, "It should be clear to everyone Russia brazenly interfered in our 2016 presidential election process and that they undertook these activities despite our strong protests and explicit warning that they do not do so." Brennan was then tasked by Clapper and President Obama to notify the key members of Congress, the Gang of Eight, of what was going on. When Brennan brought him the indicators that a Russian active measures operation was occurring on a large scale, he was assigned by the White House to coordinate with the intelligence community on the extent and impact of Russia's influence. Brennan complied and gave a series of briefs and phone calls to convince the senior national leaders that the United States had been attacked. According to the New York Times, only Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell demurred. He actively worked to keep Russia's name out of a joint letter denouncing intrusion. McConnell, like Trump, refused to believe much of the underlying intelligence on the hacking. By the end of July, suspicions had set fire to former intelligence professionals working in the news media and on the Clinton campaign. Though many of us did not have access to what was known at the CIA and NSA, it was apparent that the breadcrumbs we were seeing in the media and the whispers from former colleagues of suspicious activity was setting off alarms. Michael Morell was a former deputy director of the CIA. He had also been acting director of the agency for 3 years until John Brennan took over the job. Morell was a studious man, and though he was an informal advisor to the Clinton campaign, he had kept his opinions to himself. By August 2016, he too was seeing the writing on the wall. Trump's incessant positive references to Vladimir Putin and covering for Russia's hacking led him to publicly endorse Hillary Clinton in the New York Times. In his op-ed, he suggested that Trump was an unwitting agent for Russian intelligence. Morell went further, adding that Trump is not only unqualified for the job, but he may well pose a threat to our national security. Those were big words from a CIA officer, but as a former acting director, he was part of an extremely small club of directors who still have access to classified information and one another. He was dropping more than a hint. He was offering an unclassified assessment of the same CIA-NSA intelligence projection that would land on the desk of President Obama just 30 days later. Morell warned that Russia wanted Trump as president. Later in 2017, a member of the House Intelligence Committee asked John Brennan if he saw collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, and he answered, "I saw information and intelligence that was worthy of investigation by the FBI to determine whether or not such cooperation or collusion was taking place. I encountered and am aware of information and intelligence that revealed contacts and interactions between Russian officials and U.S. persons involved in the Trump campaign." By late fall, President Obama became so concerned, he made a bold move. He picked up the Red Phone, the war deconfliction telephone between the United States and Russian leaders, and he personally warned Vladimir Putin that America was aware of their operation and that any acts on Election Day would be seen in the harshest light. Putin did not care. The mission was to hack the minds of the American public, and it was a complete success. On October 7th, 2016, President Obama had decided that the nation needed to know about the intelligence he had about the DNC hacking. He appeared on national TV and declared that Russia had conducted the DNC hacking and that the election was at risk. Clapper's statement said, "The U.S. intelligence community is confident that the Russian government directed the recent compromises of emails from U.S. persons and institutions, including from U.S. political organizations." He continued that the unnamed Vladimir Putin had ordered these reports. "We believe, based on the scope and sensitivity of these efforts, that only Russia's senior-most officials could have authorized these activities." Unfortunately, the news of the day was not that intelligence and Homeland Security leadership were accusing Russia of intruding in the American election, but that of the Access Hollywood tape. That same day, news broke of a tape made years earlier of Trump confessing to sexual assaults and affairs. Trump bragged about conquering women and how one should grab 'em by the pussy. Not 25 minutes after Trump's Access Hollywood tape was revealed, WikiLeaks started pumping out newly stolen Podesta emails, but to no avail. The media was in a tizzy over the pussy comments. A national warning had been sounded, but thanks to the salacious nature of news media, the American public didn't really hear it. Trump remained loyal to his commitment to protect Russia. When asked 2 days later about Russian hacking, he said, "Maybe there is no hacking." While Trump was in denial about Russian interference, a new threat to the election was emerging. 36 hours after the Access Hollywood tape, investigators at the Federal Election Commission, DHS, and FBI would announce that Russia hacked into the servers of a subcontractor handling voter rolls in Florida. In the end, more than 25 other states had learned of attempts to penetrate their voter roll databases as well. Russian access to the voter rolls could allow them to change party affiliation and registration status that could disenfranchise hundreds of thousands of voters and tilt a close election to a preferred candidate. The hyper-partisan nature of the campaign led many secretaries of state to deny the attempts. All of this worked to the advantage of Russian operations to sow chaos into the narrative of the 2016 election. In the campaign, the heat of the Russian investigation was starting to take its toll. During the final presidential debate, Hillary Clinton directly stated that Putin wants to install Trump as a puppet, and Trump's only rebuttal was to childishly repeat over and over, "No, you're the puppet." WikiLeaks' impact on the news media contributed greatly to the perception that Hillary Clinton was unfit for the presidency due to repeated stories about her emails and secure server. A Google word cloud for news coverage of Clinton during the 2016 campaign showed that one word blotting out all others, emails. On November 8, 2016, nearly 139 million Americans voted. Late in the evening, it became apparent that Donald J. Trump would become the 45th president of the United States. Hillary Clinton had blown Trump away in the popular vote, winning that by 2,864,974 more votes. But it mattered not. America uses the Electoral College system, where a certain number of votes are allotted to each state. The candidate that wins 270 of these votes is the winner no matter what the popular vote. Trump won 306 Electoral College votes. When the votes were finally tallied, Trump won three critical Electoral College-filled states by flipping just 77,000 former Obama voters in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. When the election night dust settled, he was the president-elect. The unlikely victory of Donald Trump for president of the United States astounded the world. No one thought it possible that he could overcome the long odds and rise from reality TV star to become the most powerful man in the world. It was an unthinkable possibility that had unfolded. Trump brought a wave of populism from the American hinterlands. It played in the global media as the stirring story of a groundswell of American conservatism and the ultimate rejection of liberal values and policies. In Trump's vision of America, the election was a referendum on the nation's true heart. The rural American silent majority had risen and rebelled against the harsh economic tides and desecration of traditions and sought nothing more than to make itself great again. During his campaign, Donald Trump promised a nationalist, America First movement that would take them back to an America they could recognize, an America that existed before civil rights, urban riots, rights and political correctness. Trump's America had not existed since 1963, the year before the Civil Rights Act gave blacks and women full equality, and where coal and steel was the heart of the American engine. He resolved to take it right back there. In the eyes of his voters,